The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by OneClick Upsell from Zipify Apps. And I love OneClick Upsell because it offers an incredible amount of bang for the buck. If you get the app, it's simple enough and powerful enough that you can get it set up and get running in an hour or two, get those upsells in front of your customers. And in return, one in six of your customers are going to spend more with you because one in six people who are offered an upsell through OneClick Upsell actually take it. And that's money that just flows instantly without having to spend more on advertising, without having to go through painful, expensive, timely CRO processes. This is something you can set up and start seeing the fruits of right away. They've helped generate over $150 million in additional revenue for Shopify merchants just like you. So if that sounds interesting, you can learn more about OneClick Upsell and get started with them at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Hey guys, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven-figure plus e-commerce brands build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today on the show, we're talking about asset-based lending. And if you are not quite sure, you know, what asset-based lending is relative to other types of lending, I'm right there with you, or at least I was before I talked to David Golub. David is the owner of Microcom.us. It's an e-commerce store that specializes in telecommunication devices, routers, things like that. And he has a ton of experience working with banks to secure financing using things like accounts receivable, inventory, other assets, and not just assets like real estate, things like that, or stock portfolios, but e-commerce specific, business specific AP and inventory assets as collateral. And so it's a whole different world. I didn't know anything about this. And we really talk about what that looks like, why you would do that over different types of financing, how the process works. There's all sorts of different things like banks coming in and doing audits of your inventory, sometimes even having to send regular updates of your inventory, what fees are negotiable, which ones aren't, just all the lessons you'd learn from doing this for years and years as David has. So it's a great primer if you weren't super knowledgeable about it, like I wasn't, opens up a whole world of potential financing for your business. And David was a fantastic tutor slash teacher for a primer like this. Want to give a big thank you though before we jump into some of our new members inside the E-Commerce Fuel private community. Some pretty impressive brands, always fun with our new members. Had a chance to hop on with these folks in the recent past, just get to know them and their businesses. And yeah, great to have you all in the community. Chris Harrison from LibraryandCompany.com, Bobby Rieger from ElementsBrands.com. Watch out for that Bill Dallas Andrew character, Bobby. Dhruvian Patel from AkiShield.com, Joshua Colley from AmplyCellNutrition.com, Tomas DeFrancia from RoverProducts.com, Elliot Kim from Brevite.co, and Augusto Moranta from better-notyounger.com. So welcome to all of you. Great to have you inside. And if you're a seven-figure plus e-commerce brand and you want to connect deeply with other in-the-trenches experienced store owners, I think you'll like our community. Come check it out. You can learn more about what's inside, who you can connect with, as well as apply at ecommercefuel.com. Before diving in, one thing I got to mention I'm excited about. We are hiring a full-time director of events for the E-Commerce Fuel private community. Looking for a seasoned event planning pro to help get all of our wonderful members together, kind of coming out of COVID, as that's hopefully right around the corner. Yeah, it's a lot of perks with the role, a lot of freedom and flexibility to get very fun, creative, and put together unique events, lots of fun travel. Whoever is in the position is going to have a one-month sabbatical every single summer. And of course, all the standard retirement matching, retirement plan, insurance stipend, competitive salary, et cetera. So if that is you, if you happen to have a bunch of event experience or you know someone who's gifted in the event space, please check it out or let them know about it. You can learn more about the position, how to apply at ecommercefuel.com/director-of-events. And the deadline for applying is April 11th. All right, let's go ahead and jump into my discussion today with David. David, I think a great place to start is, was asking you before we hit record, if there's anything that I hadn't thought about in terms of discussion outline prep, all this kind of stuff. And you made a really good point at the top that before people, well, you said there's a much better place than asset-based lending to get money out of the gates where people should consider first before diving into this whole world, which was, you know, vendor terms. So do you want to talk about that maybe right from the outset? If people haven't considered that, they can before exhausting all the options we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So, I mean, I think what we were talking about is you know, being in an e-commerce business, there's always a money gap, or at least for me, there's always been a money gap because I always have to pay for stuff before I get paid. And so unless you have a really rich uncle who wants to give you lots of money, like you have to figure out like, where am I going to get that money from? And so usually the first place to start, or at least the first place I always start is with our suppliers. So if we can negotiate net 30, net 60, net 120, as much as they'll give us, it's almost always the best way and the easiest way to get essentially free money, because they're the ones that are most motivated to help you sell the product.
Yeah. And what are the best terms that you have ever gotten?
Well, you always ask for more than what they start with. It's always a negotiation, right? But I think, you know, net 120 is pretty generous. You know, there are other distributors out there that won't look at any deals unless they're at least net 60. You know, the bigger the distributor, the more leverage and more buying power they have.
Yeah. And I'm guessing those net 120 terms that you got probably came after years of, well, how long did it take to build up to net 120 terms? How much of a relationship did you and volume, not that's not to be exact, but just in rough terms, did you have to build up before you could get those kind of terms from your suppliers?
So actually the net 120 that we got from, that we still have from one manufacturer was kind of right out of the gate. So I almost feel like you get your best deal where you start, and you could always come back and ask for more. So if you start, let's say at net 30 and you know, you say, well, let's look at it in a year, we'll try to get to net 45, but there's always seems to be a good reason from the salesperson side why they don't want to do that. So my recommendation would be ask for as much as you can from the very get-go and assume that it's harder to negotiate. Try to negotiate, but it's harder to negotiate a year or two or three into the relationship.
When you've got that carrot of the potential business is when you've got the most leverage. Interesting. Let's dive into asset-based lending. And for people out there that maybe aren't familiar with that phrase or I've never done this before, myself included, like most loans out there, you know, whether they're SBA-backed or not, like a lot of SBA, non-SBA-backed loans need collateral, especially. So when you say asset-based lending, that term, does that just refer to any loan that has some kind of collateral attached to it, whether it could be, you know, it could be brokerage accounts, it could be real estate, things like that? Or is it kind of more of a specific type of lending that has things like, you know, more niche property like inventory and things that is held as collateral? What does that term actually mean for people who aren't super familiar with it?
Yeah, so good question. And as I'm not a banker, I'm not exactly sure all the different types of asset-based lending. It seems like banks always want collateral to lend money. They don't want to lend money on a promise that we will be profitable or we will have assets someday, or hey, like I need a mortgage, but I don't have a house. I think for me, what ABL looks different than other loans is that the bank identifies different types of assets and then wants a reporting requirement for those. So for example, with our current bank, we give them a monthly borrowing-based certificate, which details how much inventory we have, how much AR we have, and then they lend a portion against both of those assets. And then we kind of reset the maximum amount of the loan every month. So the loan has, you know, loans usually have a cap that they can't exceed, but the actual amount that you're allowed to draw against that, and these are revolving lines of credit that I've always used as to borrow with, but the actual amount that you can borrow is based on how much assets you have according to the formula that you set up at the beginning of the loan.
Interesting. And do you, so it seems like, you know, kind of much more focused on accounts receivable, inventory. Is your average bank, if you walk into either a big national, let's say like a Wells Fargo, or maybe even a smaller local bank, what are the chances they're going to have someone who's comfortable doing this versus having to go out and try to seek out, you know, someone who is, you know, more experienced in this? Actually, I think you mentioned something that I think in the forums, you mentioned that there's regular banks and specialty asset-based lending companies, but you actually prefer the regular banks over the specialists, which I found interesting. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, who's comfortable with it and what kind of bank you would pick to start the process?
Sure. So I would kind of break the asset-based lenders into two categories. They're banks, and then there's all different types of banks, right? And then there are kind of specialty ABL finance companies. And the specialty ABL finance companies work a little bit more like factors, or it's more like payday loans, things like that. So it's kind of the place that you go if at least from my experience, I would go that route if I couldn't qualify at a bank. So let's say my credit wasn't good, or, you know, I was just, you know, out of college and just starting a business and had no credit history, or my company was not profitable. So when a bank won't take you, a lot of the ABL specialty companies will, but they charge premium. And the structure of the deal is usually very constrictive. So again, as kind of a last resort, I would go that path. But I really like working with banks much better because it's more of a soft ABL lending, where you present the borrowing base certificate, and then if you've overdrawn the line, you have time to cure the overadvance. A lot of ABL specialty companies will want lock boxes, and they want to get the money first before, and then you can borrow against the money after they have the money. So,
is there any particular type of banks? So don't go towards the specific ABLs. They tend to be a little more sharkish, if that's a word. Local banks, bigger banks, do you have any tips or any even particular banks that have worked with, that you've had really good success with?
So I think it depends a little bit on how much money you want to borrow. If you go to a larger bank and you get into their middle market group, you know, they may not look at a deal that's less than $5 million. So, you know, and different banks will have different, you know, for Bank of America, it's $10 million. So part of what I've always done, at least in terms of looking for the right bank, is trying to see where I fit. So the first question I'll always ask, and by the way, finding the right bank is just a process of shopping and shopping and shopping. There are literally thousands of banks out there. And trying to find the right one is trying to find the right match of where you're going to get their attention, where you're in the sweet spot of their lending. And for particularly for asset-based loans, it comes into vogue and out of vogue at different banks. So sometimes banks will be all about asset-based lending, and then 3 or 4 years later, they're like, you know, we really want to do more real estate loans. And so finding a bank that's been doing ABL lending for a long time, and it's kind of a core part of what they do, means that you'll probably have a longer relationship with the bank once you sign a loan.
Got it. Why use asset-based lending versus, I know you sell on Amazon, you know, there's all these revenue-based loans from places like Shopify and Amazon. Why go with especially as we'll get into it, there's fees and things like that. Why pick asset-based lending versus those kind of options?
So if you're comparing ABL lending with revenue-based lending, anytime you're borrowing money as opposed to getting like a payday loan, it's going to be a lot cheaper. So Amazon, and we've borrowed money from Amazon. I think that they were at 12.5%? And they offer different rates to different borrowers. There's actually a good revenue-based lending through, if you're a Vendor Central customer, there's a company called C2FO that will advance money based on your receivables with Amazon Vendor Central. And that's currently going at 12%. But I mean, that's a lot of money. So if you're going to go to a bank, you're going to play Prime Plus. Or if you're borrowing a lot of money, maybe it's LIBOR Plus. But if you're Prime's at 3.5 right now. So if you're doing a Prime Plus, a half deal, you're at 4%.
Wow. That's amazing. So you can get rates that low is that the same? Those are rates that you're talking about on your kind of revolving line of credit. Can you get similar rates on things like term loans for asset-based lending? It's just in general, you're going to get rates in that of those ranges and those spreads that you talked about across the board.
Well, I think if you're doing a term loan, that's a little bit different. I mean, there might be ABL term loans. I'm not really familiar with that. But if you're doing a term loan, it's kind of like, all right, I want to borrow X number of dollars. And usually you start immediately repaying that. So a lot like a mortgage, right? You take out a mortgage, you buy your house, and then the next month you have to pay a good chunk of principal down. When you're borrowing money on a revolving line of credit, you're really only paying for the interest. So if you do a one-year deal or a two-year deal on a revolving line of credit, every month you have to pay the interest. And if you feel like paying down more principal, you can do that too. And if you don't have the cash to do it, then you don't pay them down, and that's fine as well. So, you know, revolving lines of credit work better for my business because, you know, sometimes customers are slow in paying. Sometimes we have a great opportunity to buy inventory. And so our cash needs are fluctuating based on the levels of the business.
What's the ratio? Let's say you've got, just to make the math easy, let's say you got $1 million in inventory and accounts receivable between the two. Or if it depends on the different type of asset, let's say $500K in inventory, $500K in accounts receivable. How much will an average bank loan you with those levels of asset-based collateral?
So that's a good question. And this is where, you really have to start delving into how ABL lending works versus just a regular line of credit. So if you have $1 million worth of assets and your company's making, you know, good money, your gross profit's good, your net profit's good, you can go to any bank at that lends in the $1 million level, and you can borrow money just based on the fact that you have a profitable business and you have assets. Where I think ABL, but they're not going to lend really aggressively. And so I think my experience has been I started with a line of credit, and then I switched banks that because they offered a bigger line of credit. And then the more I kept looking for banks that would lend more money, the more they kept kind of pushing us towards asset-based lending. Because I think it gives the banks the ability to monitor your lending really carefully, because you're doing, you know, biweekly reporting or monthly reporting or however that works, as opposed to on a regular line of credit, you know, you borrow the money, or on a term loan, you borrow the money and then, you know, maybe you talk again in a year or two or whenever your loan is up for renewal. But with asset-based lending, they see your numbers every single month or every single reporting period that you set up in the loan. And so it lets them be a little more aggressive and lend a higher amount of money, which is always what, you know, it's been important for what we're doing at Microco.
What if I'm a bank, and let's say, I mean, you sell kind of telecom equipment, wireless routers, things like that. I'm overgeneralizing here, but what, from a bank's perspective, and this is more of just it's not as much applicable to anyone, more of just a curiosity point. What happens when a bank buys, you know, if they have to foreclose on something, they end up with $500,000 in routers, or, you know, like what do they, I mean, no bank is going to want that, right? Banks don't want houses, let alone $500,000 in routers or whatever, you know, all these esoteric things that all of us sell in, you know, the niche e-commerce world. What do they do with that? Do they hire a liquidator and just hand it off and write off the loss difference? Or how does that look on the back end if things come to that from the bank's perspective?
You know, yes, banks hate inventory, and I guess I've been fortunate that I've never been foreclosed on, so I haven't really seen how that process goes. I think they go from being very nice to being very not nice. So look, you're right. It's a nightmare scenario. The bank does not want your inventory, and if they do, they're certainly not going to sell it as well as you can sell it, and it's probably they're just looking to take a haircut and get out. But what banks will do is they do like some types of inventory better than other types of inventory. So if you are a manufacturer, for example, and you have most of your inventory is raw materials or there's work in process, they don't like to lend against that. So if you have finished goods, that's always better. So we as a distributor, we don't make anything ourselves. So everything that we have is saleable. The other things that banks don't like is they don't like inventory that declines in value. So if you're selling product that today costs 100, but then in 2 months, it's going to only be worth 80 because it's the latest and greatest tech thing, they don't like that. So, and these things are important, I think, when you're negotiating with the bank, because the more that you can play up why your inventory is good and why the business is interesting, you're selling, right? You're selling to the bank. The more that you can get them interested and they can tell a story to their credit officer, they'll be, yes, they're all going to crunch the numbers and spread them out. But when the story is good, it usually lets them be a little bit more creative in how they approach how much they want to lend and what the terms of the loan would be. So yeah, so always play to your strengths. If you have stuff that is really easy to liquidate, then tell that to the banker and say, look, if you know, if things ever go south and you need to get rid of my inventory, here's what we sell and here's why it's so easy to get rid of. We've actually used the Amazon connection, even though they don't like the inventory or the concentration at Amazon or the inventory at Amazon. What they do like is that it's already in a pre-ready to sale mode. And with the most recent bank that we signed up with, you know, I made a big pitch about, hey, listen, if you had to foreclose, it's not like you're going to take the inventory and sell it off to a liquidator. The inventory is actually already at Amazon. You could just lower the price a little bit and sell through in 30 days. And they love that. So yeah, it's definitely how you know, it's in the, you know, the inventory is the inventory, right? Depending on what business you're in, but you can definitely tell a story and highlight your strengths when you're talking with the bank.
How does this process, obviously, you know, this is a reasonable level of due diligence on the bank's part to come in, you know, look at it. It's not, you just can't just send over financial statements from your bank to prove collateral. They're going to have to come get a sense of you know, the quality of the inventory for by all the levels you talked about from the bank's perspective. Walk through, if you would, what does this process look like in terms of how does the loan process work, maybe on a one-time basis as well as ongoing? Because I think you had mentioned kind of in the form comment that you had audits, there's one-time fees to kind of have people come, like there's a lump sum, kind of a lot of work up front, and there's the ongoing reporting. So could you walk through a sense of how it works to get started, what the process looks like, what the banks ask for in terms of all that research and the fees involved there?
Yeah. So there's a lot of paperwork involved. So my suggestion is if you're shopping for banks, try to shop with multiple banks because they're all going to ask for basically the same thing. And, you know, when you put together that fit, you know, all the documents that they want, it's a whole lot more palatable when you know you're sending it out to 10 banks than when you're sending it out to one. So, but I mean, I would think of it like a two-step process. So the first is you're trying to get their interest. And so after an initial conversation or initial, you know, back and forth with the bank where you find out if you're in the right division or the right lending area for the bank, the first thing they're going to want is a ton of documents. So they're going to want your financial statements and your tax returns and your personal financial statement and your AR aging and your inventory aging, they'll have a whole list of documents that they want you to prepare and send to them. And then after they look at that, if they're interested and they want to take it to the next step, that's kind of when the second phase begins. So after they've gone through and they've laid everything out, and they might come back and say, okay, we're ready to give you a term sheet. Here's our proposal. And then if you accept this, then we're going to go to phase two. And then phase two is basically verifying everything that they saw in phase one. So if you gave them an AR aging, they might want to see invoices related to the AR aging. They might want to call the company and verify that they actually owe you that money. If it's an inventory, if you tell them you have X number of dollars in inventory, they're going to want to see breakdown. Well, how many pieces and how did you come up with that valuation? And by the way, can we come in and can we count the inventory so that we know it's physically there? So they're not going to count everything, but they might do a sample count or they might select three or four items and really sort of go after. And so as you're in this sort of two-phase process, you know, you get the term sheet and then you select the bank and then it's really sort of game on in terms of fees and all the diligence work in order to close the loan.
And do they charge you, like what are standard? I mean, a lot of times if you think about getting a mortgage, for example, you've got, you know, the origination fee and all these, you know, appraisal fees, all these kind of things. What are some of the fees that are standard when you're getting ready to close a loan like this?
Yeah, banks love to charge fees, don't they?
I was going to say, if I was loaning, if I was in the bank position loaning, you know, at 5% against a bunch of, you know, random inventory, I feel like otherwise, if they don't charge fees, it seems like a rough business to be in.
So when you're in that first part of the sending documents, then there's no money, right? So then it's only once they give you the term sheet that they'll identify what it is that you have to do in order to close the loan, and then what it is that you have to do on an ongoing basis after that. And that's where I think, you know, things are flexible and things are negotiable. So the bank may say, hey, we have a closing fee of 1% or 0.5%, or they may come up with a renewal fee, like it'll do a 2-year deal, but it has a percentage after 1 year where you pay a renewal fee. Or like, and they'll spell all this out in the term sheet. So at that point, I think that's your opportunity to go back and negotiate both the rate of the loan and the fees that are in the loan. And there's certain fees that they'll move on, and then there's some that it's kind of in their DNA that's just that they won't budge.
Hey, it's Andrew here with a quick aside. And you obviously love e-commerce. You're interested in that. And so I wanted to make sure you're aware of the private community we have at E-commerce Fuel for 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brand owners. And it's something we've been building for close to a decade now with over 1,100 members across the globe. And our secret sauce, like the name implies, is that everyone inside has deep experience doing this with an owner mindset. And so what does that mean? It means you get, when you log into our form, you get fast, on-point answers to your most pressing questions, regardless of whether that's you're negotiating a new lease for a warehouse, or maybe you're negotiating with UPS or USPS or FedEx about shipping rates or pickup times, or potentially you're just looking to find a great outsourcer, or wondering if you can even outsource your content. Is that something anyone has had success with? You can tap into this huge knowledge and brain trust across the globe and get answers within hours, sometimes even minutes. So it's an incredibly active forum with experienced people. You get to plug into an amazing network worldwide. A lot of our members, when they travel, if they touch down in Dallas or Sydney or London or Bozeman, Montana, or whatever it is, oftentimes they'll reach out to other ECF members, obviously a little harder to do potentially right now, but and see if they want to get together for a beer to connect and just, and oftentimes get to know a new friend. So it's an amazing network, as well as invites to our member-only events like ECF Live, which is our annual summit gathering for about 200 people. And then finally, the intelligence in our community just that's shared helps you avoid making really costly hiring and software mistakes. So our members write reviews on what they're using, their software tools or agencies, completely unbiased, completely from their own experience. And so you can avoid making that, you know, hiring that agency that's an absolute nightmare, but you don't know about it. Or you can hone in on the one that actually does a really good job. So it saves you a ton of time and money from bad hiring and software decisions. So if any of this sounds interesting, head on over to ecommercefuel.com and you can learn more about the community, what's included, and apply for membership as well. All right, let's go ahead and jump back in to the discussion. Which fees for someone who's coming into this as an absolute newbie doing their first term sheet with a bank, what can they feel a little confident asking, hey, you know, pushing a little bit harder on saying, hey, let's move this. Those fees you said that are negotiable, what are some of those?
I think it depends on the bank, but any, I think it's all up for negotiation. If they say it's going to be prime plus two, come back and ask for prime plus one. They're going to look at the overall profitability of the loan. So the rates and the fees tend to go hand in hand. So if you agreed to do what for them would be a big spread on the loan, let's say prime plus three, they might waive most or all of the fees because they're making so much money on the interest. So, but in terms of fees, I would push back on closing fees, renewal fees, you know, things like that where the bank really has control over it. You'll have less success, I think, in terms of outside services that the bank has to hire. So let's say, for example, they decide to bring in both an inventory appraisal company and an inventory audit company, because that's what they do. That's part of their process. You're going to have to pay for both of those fees. Now, you might be able to negotiate a cap, so like a not to exceed number. But in general, if the bank has to spend that money, then you're probably going to have to pay that money. When the bank is spending the money, you probably can't negotiate. But if it's a closing fee or a renewal fee or something where it's just part of how much money the bank makes, then I think you have the ability to push a little bit there.
And so on an ongoing basis, how often, obviously you have the reporting that you have to do, I think you mentioned on a monthly basis, so they know how inventory levels are looking, AR, et cetera. How often after that initial closing period is either the bank or people they hire actually coming to your warehouse and diving around and counting stuff? Like, is that something that happens? I'm guessing not on a monthly basis, but do they kind of do a physical check every 3 months, 6 months, every year? How often does that happen?
So every bank has sort of a different standard rule. And then if you get into trouble or your numbers don't look quite what they want, then they're going to increase the frequency. But again, this is part of that initial negotiation. If they say, hey, we want to do an audit every 6 months, maybe you push back because you know the audit's going to cost money and time and effort. And like, we actually have to shut down shipping for a period of hours while they go in and they count inventory. So I think you can make a case, again, before you actually sign the term sheet and it's kind of game on and let's go, that's the time to ask for as little reporting, as little outside services that need to be done, as little money that you have to pay. That's all the time to negotiate those. And so every bank will be different. I would say you probably will have to do at least one AR audit, inventory audit at the very beginning. And then after that, it's up to the bank. So maybe annual, maybe every 6 months, maybe every 2 years, depending on what you can negotiate. And that's a good thing to negotiate on a renewal too.
You had mentioned a handful of terms. We're not super clear for people who haven't done this. I thought I'd love to just kind of go through these just quickly, tick by tick, and give an idea of what they are and if they're negotiable or not. One is a lockbox for receivables. So is that the idea of if you have receivables from someone, instead of them mailing them right to you as the company, they get mailed right to the bank and then the bank deposits them? Or you know, is that kind of the thought process there? And is that part of the is it negotiable in the agreement?
Yeah, so that's what those ABL specialty companies, specialty finance companies, they love lockbox receivables because it really mitigates their risk. You can't collect the money from the customer and then disappear on a jet and fly off to some island somewhere. The money goes to them first, and then they, after you submit an updated borrowing base certificate, then you can borrow against that money. And all of this is time, right? So if you have to have if the bank or the lender in general requires a lockbox, they've locked you out of your own money for a period of time. So, I mean, I've never done a deal like that. To me, it seemed like it would be really cumbersome and stressful because if I need the money to pay a vendor and it's dragging on for 2 days or 3 days or 4 days, you know, the vendor's waiting to get paid, it seemed like, I don't know, that's something I wanted to have to deal with, that headache. So, but lockboxes is something that if they start going down that path and that's the way that they lend, then you have to, if that's the way you want to borrow, then I guess you have to feel comfortable with how that'll work. I mean, other covenants to look out for, like, so all of the ABL, the devil is always in the details, right? All of the lending things that make things work short-term and long-term are usually in the deal from the very beginning. You know, as we've made mistakes borrowing from different lenders, not really paying attention to the, you know, how much of an imposition certain of the covenants would be. I think that's the reason why we've been switching banks. You know, you stay with the bank for a few years, and then you get a better deal from another bank where they waive a certain requirement. So one of the things that banks love to do is they love to cap the amount of lending on your AR. On your inventory, I mean, to not exceed your AR. So for a company like us, we always have more inventory than AR. We're always buying the inventory first, and then we're selling it out to customers second. And so if we were to have a cap based on our percentage of inventory to not exceed that of AR, that it's just basically a way of the banks not lending you as much money on the inventory.
Is that what you mean by inventory sublimit? Is that what that's called?
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly.
What's a Bailey waiver? I might even be mispronouncing that.
So a Bailey waiver. So this is what I find so interesting is that you would think that the banks would all have a similar way of lending to all of their customers, but it's really like every bank has their own. They have their own rules and that they've set up internally. And so I never heard of a Bailey waiver until we refinanced at the end of 2020. And the bank said, nope, we need a Bailey waiver. And we're like, what's that? And essentially what it is you are pre-waiving your rights and you're allowing the bank in the event of foreclosure to come into your premises and seize your inventory. So, you know, and I think, look, this is all about banks mitigating their risk and protecting their ability to collect in case of foreclosure. So, but a Bailey waiver was... We've signed like landlord agreements, but they specifically wanted something that said Bailey waiver on it. So they had a form and we signed it. And that was one of the sort of non-negotiable terms because that was something that was really, really important to them. So we agreed.
Interesting. Piece of paper with your signature they can show to the sheriff that so he'll let them into your warehouse. Pretty much crazy. What with all these terms you kind of alluded to that you've kind of through trial and error over the years, to kind of hone your sense for what you're comfortable doing and whatnot. What's one of the more onerous terms you've agreed to or one of the more regretful mistakes you've made you'll never do again?
Well, definitely that inventory sublimit was a mistake. We've had ABL loans that had restriction on government receivables, which they didn't want government receivables. They only wanted private company receivables. They wouldn't lend against government receivables. Sometimes there are restrictions on how much you can sell overseas because they think it'll be harder to collect from a foreign company than from a U.S. company. And then I think that the main one that always comes up is customer concentration. So So actually, I had an interesting conversation with the bank about Amazon, because Amazon has become a bigger and bigger customer for us. And so this last bank, they still put on a concentration, but I was trying to argue that Amazon isn't really a concentration at all, because even though Amazon's collecting the money, they're not actually the buyer. The buyers are all the individual people that are buying on Amazon, if you're selling through Seller Central. And so therefore, there isn't really any concentration at all. It's just that the money is all coming from one source. And they were like, no, nice try. But they did at least say, okay, but we understand that in the event of collection, it's not like they can just cut you off like a regular retailer could. Like if you were selling to Target and Target wasn't paying you, they could also leverage you by not buying from you. So in this situation, they said, okay, well, we understand that the orders would continue to come in. And so we'll give you a higher concentration, a higher limit on Amazon than we will on other customers. But definitely, it's always in those little details of you know, walk through an actual borrowing base example. You know, once you're ready to pull the trigger, walk through one of the borrowing base examples with the lender and say, okay, well, how do we fill this out? And what is, you know, what is line 23? What does this mean? And then and actually fill one out. And then I think by doing the borrowing base together with the bank, you'll see how they apply the different covenants to the loan and the different specific limits on how they lend against the loan. Other things that I would look for? Yeah, or I think we didn't really talk about covenants, but there's always covenants. So they might have a maximum lending ratio, or they might have they want your quick ratio to be a certain number, or they might be looking at your profitability and they want either a certain amount of EBITDA over a certain period of time, or measured over quarterly, or rolling 3 month, or 6 month, or something. So, and again, I think all these covenants are negotiable, but you'll quickly see which ones the bank doesn't want to negotiate.
So as a rule, try to negotiate everything. It's and you'll quickly find out. I should have asked this right out of the gates, but do you have to personally guarantee these loans? Like, is that something you normally have to do, or it just depends on the amount of collateral you have relative to the loan?
I've always had to negotiate to personally guarantee every loan that we've signed, which is always fun when I get to come home and say, "Honey, guess what? yes, they need your signature too." So I think if you can really build a big enough business and borrow enough money, I have seen friends that have built much bigger businesses eventually get out of the personal guarantee requirement. But unfortunately, I've always had to sign a PG.
Yeah, I figured that was the case, but thought I'd ask in case it just got lucky. Well, David, this has been fascinating. It's kind of a world I know, like I said at the top, nothing about, and obviously a nuanced one. So appreciate you talking through it. And I'd love to wrap up with a lightning round here before we put a bow on the episode. Before we do, I mentioned at the top of the episode, microcom.us. is your business. It's what's, of course, you've built using this, a lot of stuff we talked about today on the lending side. For people who, can you talk quickly about your products and the product line that you have in case there's anything that, some of our listeners could maybe use or purchase from you on the telecom router side of things?
Sure. So we're essentially a wholesaler of routers and switches and VoIP hardware and access points, things that are used for internet deployment and distribution. We have about 30, 35 brands that we distribute. I think the one thing that makes us a little bit unique among distributors is that we also teach classes, which has not been the greatest business in the middle of a pandemic. But post-pandemic, I'm hoping we get back to, because they're all in person. So I'm hoping we get back and we start really ramping that business back up. But we do teach in-class, hands-on certification classes for a bunch of the product lines that we distribute.
Very cool. So microcom.us if you're in the market for any of that kind of stuff. So lightning round, we'll hit it really quickly here. Feel free to just, as the name suggests, rapid fire answers. But first question is, what's your favorite piece of e-commerce tech?
Does Amazon qualify? Because I would say Amazon has been the most fun in the last 5 years.
I think it qualifies. Least favorite piece of e-commerce tech?
Definitely also Amazon.
What's one of your fonder memories from your childhood?
My dad would take my brother and I deep sea fishing when we went to go visit the grandparents in Florida. So we would go visit his folks, and we would spend some time with the grandparents, and then he would take us out on a boat and we would go sailfish fishing.
Very cool. Oh, what's been the most effective marketing strategy for you in the last 6 months?
You know, we just revamped our email marketing using connections at ECF. So I think the email marketing that we kind of let languish for a long time is so much better in the last several months. And I think that's part of being in the group and getting recommendations from everybody at ECF.
Great. Was there a specific tactic you were going after, or was it just a factor or an issue of getting someone to focus on it full time and put some energy and love into it?
But probably the latter, and also just really understanding that we had a large mailing base that we had some old software that wasn't really effectively segmenting and hitting the right people with the right message. And so I think so that sort of you know segmenting and getting the email out to the right person has been much more effective than what we were doing before.
Was there a major seminal moment or period in your life that you can look back on and see, like, hey, this was a big catalyst or a big inflection point or really changed or shaped who I am today?
I don't know, maybe going to college. Just the whole sort of leaving home and going away and discovering, you know, who I was at the age, I was 17 when I started college. And I find it interesting that it was 4 years of my life, but I remember so much detail from each year.
Yeah, agreed. It's pretty amazing how you can, even like freshman year, I don't know for you, I feel like for me, my freshman year was my most notable year. But yeah, it's the same way. I can remember a lot of it. Crazy detail. And last question, who's the most interesting person you've met as a part of ECF? I think you've been a member for about a year, which has been, it's been wonderful having you. Anyone that you've met in that time period that you've either really connected with or just was really blown away by kind of what they're doing or insights?
So I'm hoping to go to the next ECF Live because I would love to meet more of the folks in this group. They're just some really fascinating. I'll sometimes just watch some of the forum posts and just amazed by how entrepreneurially savvy so many people are in this group. But I think the people that first I actually got to meet before the pandemic hit, and we did a quick little meetup in LA, and I met Matt and Meredith, and I think they gave me faith that there's a whole different way of selling. It didn't revolve around Amazon, and it was a whole way of sort of creating a community and then creating sales afterward. I was just super impressed with their abilities to do that. And they're interesting people too. And they write really well, both of them.
They're funny. Yeah. They've got a great sense of humor as well. Well, great. Well, David, thank you so much. It's been wonderful having you in the community. Thanks for diving deep on asset-based lending. And yeah, hope things go well with microcom.us, and hopefully looking forward to, yeah, meeting you at the next ECF Live as soon as this obnoxious pandemic gets hopefully put behind us here in the next 6 months or so. But yeah, thank you so much for being willing to share.
Well, thanks for having me on the podcast. And one of the things, just one quick thing is that if anybody ever has term sheets or anything that they have that they want some sort of one-on-one review, I've done that with a couple of people behind the scenes, and I'm happy to share my experience or recommendations or, you know, tell you what I think of the offer. So happy to help anybody who runs into that at ECF.
Wow. Thank you. That's super generous. I'll link up to your kind of profile and contact information in the show notes in the community so people can take you up on that. So thank you.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
That's going to do it for this week. A big thank you again to OneClick Upsell for making the show possible. Learn more about how to offer powerful upsells to your customers at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And if you're a store owner, an in-the-trenches store owner looking for your tribe, you really need to join us inside the eCommerce Fuel private community. It's the world's largest, most active community of 7- and 8-figure e-commerce store owners with a thriving discussion forum, software and agency reviews, live events, and much more. You can learn more about our community and apply at ecommercefuel.com. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard and adventure often. And I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.
The ASY Radio Network, live from New York.